Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Placer from GameWisdom.com, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great cast for you this week, and welcome to the Perceptive Podcast. Our topic is going to be once again returning to indie publishing. It's one of those areas that there really isn't a lot of concrete information on, and yet it's very important, especially for enthusiasts or first-time developers taking that step into the world of game development and hopefully selling their game. My guest tonight, he is the co-founder of the indie publishing company Indie Voyage. So please welcome to the cast, Rob Leach.
Thanks for having me on the show, Josh.
It's a pleasure to have you on, Rob. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. It's Friday, so I can't complain at all.
Awesome. Yeah, it's always great when it's Friday. And though here, right now when we're recording, it seems like we're still in that damn summer heat wave. I'm hoping things will break soon.
Yeah. It's a little cooler over here in Portland, but, you know, it's always a little too warm in summer.
Yes, it is. And for those of you listening to this cast now, for this day that we're recording, it's been a busy one for me. I recorded a previous cast, my critical thought, and some Twitch streaming. So by the end of today, I think my voice will basically be completely gone. So we'll see what happens. All right. So to get started with, and since this is your first time on the cast, Rob, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what is Indie Voyage about?
Sure. My name's Rob Leach. I've been in the games industry for 14 and a half years, and I've been in just about every area. I started out in console doing sports games. I then moved to early mobile. This was pre-iOS mobile. And then from there, I went to this company that did installation type games, where we installed a poker game in Vegas as kind of a game show, and then we did the same thing on a cruise ship, and both of those experiences were tremendous and very out there. Work doing educational games at WayForward and Disney, and now I'm working in on the side, I'm working in a company that does kind of a wagering in games kind of thing, but looking to do Indie Voyage all the time.
And with Indie Voyage, this is you're obviously the co-founder of the publishing house. How many games have you published at the moment?
Well, our first game we published was Reassembly, and that contract finished in February, but he, of course, is still selling the game. It's a fantastic vector-based game. We have recently launched a kind of resurrected Zavix Tower. They started out as free to play, and we have helped them switch to a paid version. And now we are about to launch Venture Forth, which by the time this airs may be out of early access, but is currently, as I speak, in early access. And that is a great adventure type game. We have just signed on another game, and we're looking to sign on a couple more. But we're in the kind of early stages of our company, just growing outwards now.
Yeah. All right. Do you cater exclusively to PC indie developers, or do you also do mobile or other platforms?
We tend to stay away from mobile. It's a little overly competitive right now. And in terms of selling a game, most are free to play. And that is a really tricky business to get into for any developer, let alone an indie developer. So we tend to stick to Steam games. We will look at games that, you know, branch into Linux and Mac. But PC tends to be that big market, and gamers tend to buy multiple games at once, even if it's in the same genre. So we tend to stick there. It's a little easier to be successful, even at a small scale.
Yeah. And as you were just talking about, Rob, your background in the industry goes back. How long did you say you were in this?
14 and a half years.
Yeah. So you've had a chance. You've basically lived through some of like the major changes that's been going on in this industry, especially over the last decade with the rise of digital distribution. And really, as I think both of us are well aware of, how the independent market has really solidified into its own thing. I still remember back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when the term indie usually just meant shovelware or, you know, like the cute Flash game on something like Shockwave or ConverGrid. And, I mean, today, the amount of creativity and just the market has just become phenomenal.
Yeah, especially as younger developers are actually going to specialty schools and learning all about the business and becoming specialists in either programming or art or sound. And just that kind of core, they can team together and just make these amazing games that are rich with graphics and sound and depth.
Yeah, and it's easier now than ever to be able to make a game as long as you can learn a game engine or get two or three people together. It is possible to start on your own track. I mean, I still remember going to college in the mid-thousands, and most colleges at that time, unless it was a specialty one like DigiPen or like an Art Academy, they really weren't thinking about game development as being this massive thing. And now we flash forward to today, and not only does it seem that it's in the college level, but we're seeing like courses and such in high school too about introducing people to this kind of production.
Yeah, and you're dating me a bit. I went to college in the mid-90s, and the only schools I was aware of at the time that did this kind of stuff were like Full Sail in Orlando.
Yeah.
And midway through college is when I learned about this stuff, and it was just too late for me to try and transfer to a place like that.
Yeah.
And at my college, all we had was kind of a low-budget film program that was called Media Arts and didn't really involve much film because it was too expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, my college was pretty much phasing out their computer science wing, saying that this was going to be it. And then, like, I found like a year or two later, they started a game design course after I graduated. So, I mean, that just hurt really bad.
Yeah, it's always the way.
Yeah. But getting back to your background, your experience, as someone who's been doing this for 14 and a half years, I guess as someone who has both, you know, worked on games, been marketing them and now publishing them, I guess, what are your thoughts on like the current state of the market?
That is it's a very interesting question. Because you have these AAA games that dominated all markets, as you said, and you only had independents working in very scattered markets. But now you can find indie games on all consoles, and of course, it's just all over PC and Steam. And in fact, AAA on Steam seems to be kind of a smaller market. Obviously, people still buy the AAA games, but the indie market is so rich and interesting and generally cheaper that finding a game you like there, and even many games you like there, is much easier. For a gamer, it is just the best kind of world to live in.
Now, one question that I have for you, and I asked this when I spoke with, I think, Daniel of Black Shell Media, is about how saturated things are today, especially not just in the AAA market, but in the indie market as well. It seems like literally every day there is a new game coming out. And it feels, from a consumer side, that it's very hard to keep track of, you know, what's latest, what's hot. And I know for the development side of things, I've spoken to a lot of developers off recording about how hard it really is sometimes to get your game in front of an audience.
Yeah, it is. It has to start before the design process has really hit its stride. It has to continue well after launch to get people looking at your game. It is so hard to do. You've just got to, you know, get yourself to the niche market that will like you best and hope that they kind of grab you. I know the saturation bleeds into my own Steam experience, where I own hundreds of games, but I've only played like a very small percentage of them. And my wish list is just huge.
I have given up on that wish list. It's just it doesn't help anymore. There's just too many games, and it's always like it gets to the point where I bought games and I forget where I get them from. And it doesn't help now that I get access to press copies. So now I get games and it just seems like there's more games out there than there is time in the day.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Now, with this from like a publishing point of view, I guess for you, Rob, what is kind of like your day-to-day job when it comes to like helping developers and getting their games out there for people to play?
Well, I would say that the minutiae part of things is just taking the game and trying to get it in front of, well, you know, people like yourself who are podcasters or YouTubers or Twitchers and who are looking to either look at indie games or even interview like you're doing now, developers for their perspective on things. And that helps get our game out there a little bit. But additionally, it's always looking for other ways, whether it be just going into forums of people who are, like, for example, with Zavix Tower, I've found that RPG Watch is a good place to go because those guys are always looking for new RPG games. And then, you know, just keep looking for those forums and those small ways to kind of get in front of people, make them see your game and at least make that decision of whether or not they'd like to buy it. But yeah, also just keeping in touch with the developer, finding out what it is that they're accomplishing and making sure they give you notes on when they make a new release and what notes I need to put on Twitter and Facebook and every other media point that they're involved in and we're involved in, just to get it out there to as many human beings as possible.
Yeah. And it's always tricky, especially trying to help independent developers. One of the things I've seen and have witnessed with talking to developers is that there are a great number of people who have either very little interest or no interest in doing the PR side of things. And this is one of those things I think, especially for someone like you who's been doing this for 14 and a half years, you probably have experienced this yourself with just the growing importance of the PR side of the game industry. And I spoke with several developers in the past about that balance between the quote-unquote artist and the businessman and what it means to be able to make a quality game but still understand how to sell it and market it to people.
Yeah, it's true. And honestly, all three of our games that are coming out now or that are either out or coming out, and then the one that's going to be coming out sometime in 2017, they're all individual developers and just single person teams. And for them to know how to do everything is just, it is incredibly rare and difficult to find, which, you know, our reassembly, Arthur Danskin, was relatively good about all that. Basically my job with him was not only to do some of this stuff, my partner took on a lot of the marketing piece, but just to be there as kind of a person to bounce ideas off of, make sure he was on track for certain dates that he sets. We try not to set the dates for an indie developer because we want them to be able to finish their game. And get the best product out there. But with Jeremy, who's also just an incredibly intelligent person and a master developer, he is just trying to get his game done. And he is smart about the PR stuff, too, and he's learning very fast. But it's up to us to fill in the gaps and help him find his team. Chris of Zavix Tower, he's also that kind of person, but he wants to step away. He wants to focus on his game and let us do the rest of it.
Yeah, and that is definitely a statement that I hear from a lot of developers. And one of the things I hear quite often is, like, especially as you said, Rob, for like one or two man development teams is, why should I take, you know, 3-4 hours a day to do PR when I can apply that to making my own game? And it's a good point, but it's becoming, as we're seeing, more and more important to have someone in your corner who can do this work for you. Because it doesn't matter how great your game is if no one knows what it is when it gets released.
Yeah. I mean, I know once you get to a 5 or 6 man team, you can start to put people on that stuff. But when you are that small, you definitely, you can use someone in your corner. If you're good at that stuff, then that's awesome. But yeah, you usually need someone at least for some kind of support, especially in a couple of cases where you're a little older, you have a family or even a day job. That makes it even harder because your time is much more limited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as you're saying, Rob, and this is something I definitely know about, it's very, very rare to find someone that perfect combination who does everything. The guy who can program his own games, whose own art, design them, and market them all by himself. There are a few out there, but it's one of those things that, especially for students and enthusiasts listening, it's very important, I think, to find people to supplement your own abilities, especially in a market like this where I think that the bar has been raised quite high for independent, or actually not just independent development, but just game development as a whole. And I guess for you, Rob, again, with your experience, would you agree with that about like the quality level has gone up?
Oh, absolutely. Like I was saying earlier about these colleges that are very specific, mm-hmm. you get artists that are just stepping out of school mm-hmm. who are incredibly talented and skilled and have put in hundreds and hundreds of hours, perhaps thousands, in their craft. Mm-hmm. So they're already nearly masters when they graduate school.
Yeah.
The only experience they're missing is doing professional work.
Mm-hmm.
But they're only steps away, and not only is it difficult to find a professional job, but you do have access to a ton of other people who are in the same position and have a variety of different skills.
Mm-hmm.
So you can just team up with a few people and make a fantastic title. That raises the bar for everybody, including hobbyists mm-hmm. and whatnot.
Yeah. And I think that has also been sort of part of the issue, really, with a lot of independent developers, especially those who were used to the older days, trying to keep afloat. I think the bottom, in a sense, of the independent market has kind of dropped out. Like the days where you could just make, like, let's say a simple Pac-Man clone or a Breakout clone and sell it for $5 to $10 is, I think, past us. People are expecting a lot more for their games. I think all the more so with the rise of the free-to-play and mobile market. You said a few minutes ago that you have worked in the mobile space before, and that kind of industry has really, I think, twisted a lot in terms of affecting what consumers expect from a game. As a good example, I mean, we can see games, $60 games like Call of Duty, No Man's Sky, Halo, etc. And on the other end of the spectrum, we have, you know, the free-to-play or 99-cent games, your Farmvilles, Flappy Birds, Clash of Clans, etc.
Mm-hmm. And the funny part about the mobile market is that of the top, say, 40 or 50 titles in terms of money-making, Minecraft was the only paid game that managed to crack that list. And the top 10 are always free to play.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it that much harder because those top 10 now just earn enough money to market millions
yes.
of dollars. They get Super Bowl ads now.
Oh,
and
yes.
that's just is crazy.
I know. It is weird to see, like, oh, what was that game? It was at the Super Bowl. I think it had a supermodel as like the advertiser. I know there's one with Arnold Schwarzenegger in now.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
you're right, it is insane. You have stuff like Kim Kardashian's Hollywood as well.
Yeah.
And the problem, and I think this is one thing that I've been worried about, I even made a post about this earlier in 2016 about why I don't think mobile is going, at least in its current state, is a sustainable market, is because of these games. The mobile market, as you said, is dominated by a few of the top people. You know, stuff like Clash of Clans, Farmville, Rovio, etc. And once they become that top tier, they have the marketing dollars and clout to make sure that they're always going to be, you know, number one on an iOS store or on the front page constantly. And mm-hmm. it's becoming harder and harder to get your game there. Not only do you have to compete with them, but you also compete with, you know, the dozens or even hundreds of other developers who are all trying to do the same thing that you are.
Mm-hmm. And you occasionally get that story of like a Flappy Bird where it's made by one mm-hmm. person. It just rises to the top of the most played list. And he's able to generate a lot of money for ads, but then that quickly just disappears.
Mm-hmm.
And that's only a one-off kind of story. It's like a one-hit wonder,
yes.
you know? that's hard to do. It's almost luck.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And we could arguably say some of that for the independent space as well. I've seen some amazing games just literally pop out of nowhere. Like, even in terms of, like, what I read itself, like a game like Stardew Valley, it just seemed like one day it appeared and it just dominated the storefront. And we could also say something like Undertale as well. And there is the argument that these are high quality games, and they definitely are, and that quality will beat out marketing to some extent. But I think those are still exceptions to the norm, that you still need to be able to get your word out if you want your game to be that success.
Yeah, and that's why I constantly try to focus marketing in on a very small group of people, because you can always find someone who's going to like your game, and that group could be tens of thousands of people, because mm-hmm. there are tens of millions of people that are playing these games. Mm-hmm. So you can always find a good group that'll... for a one or two man team mm-hmm. can make you a good amount of money to not only get you to your next game, but allow you to expand your team a little bit and just a little more and a little more to getting your own kind of indie company, which is a good goal to have, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And being able to make that company these days has also become a lot easier. I mean, again, we can remember back in the late 90s into the early 2000s where the only way you were going to make a game is if you were part of a 20 to 30 man group. You had your own office and a publisher backing you for, who knows, 12 months and maybe even a year or two. And these days, you can have teams as small as one man who can put out their own game. And it's just a very interesting time. And again, like, these are things that 10 years ago, I never would have thought we would be talking about. If, for those of you listening, it's time for you to take a sip of your drink. But Steam itself, like, I never thought Steam was going to be this amazing thing. And it has just revolutionized just about all aspects of the game industry and development.
Yeah. It absolutely has. And real quick to your point about how the game industry has morphed a bit into allowing more options is what we're doing right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're on the East Coast, I'm on the West Coast, and we're talking together. And mm-hmm. you can do that with a team. My partner yes. is in Sacramento, and our indie developers are scattered all over the place. Mm-hmm. We're trying to actually land a developer who's in Spain. So yeah. it blows my mind. Like what the possibilities are. You no longer need an office at all.
Yeah, and talking about that international aspect, I mean, I'm still amazed with what I'm doing here with Game Wisdom. We're going to be going on 4 years in October, and in that time, for someone who has barely left the East Coast of the United States, I've spoken to developers and people not just all over the United States, but Canada, Spain, Croatia, Africa, India, Malaysia. And again, like, you wouldn't have this 10 years ago, or I'm sorry, even like 10 or 20 years ago, this would not be happening. And it is just amazing to be able to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just an open world, and while it is difficult to make these games, it's also very rewarding. And I know a lot of these indie developers, you know, they have a great concept and they want to get it out there, and mm-hmm. they finish it. And even when they don't make a ton of money, even when they almost fail sometimes, you can be very proud of the product you made yeah. and be wanting to do it again.
Oh, yeah. That is a definite factor, especially for independent developers. I think it also has to do with this kind of transparency that we're seeing more from the indie space. It's not just a company. Like, when you say EA, you know, who are you really talking about? There's a giant conglomerate there. But when you say something like Clay Entertainment or Abbey Games, and even your one- to two-man studios, there is a face, there is a person there. And you can really see that energy. And I think the consumer really responds to that transparency that we have now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think going back to what you were just saying, Rob, regarding even if they fail or come close to failing, they still want to do it again, it's really that level of passion. It's going back to what I was saying earlier regarding the businessman, the artist. That is definitely the artist coming through. And you need to, I think, have both of those mentalities to really be able to succeed. You need to be able to have that passion, that drive, but it's also important to understand, how is this game going to appeal to people? And there's that difference between making a game just for yourself and, you know, your five friends, and making a game that, you know, someone on the West Coast of the United States or someone over in Australia can both enjoy and appreciate your title.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the independence, especially for a publishing and marketing side of things, another major aspect, actually there's two we can talk about, but we'll go with this one first, is definitely crowdfunding. Whether it's Patreon, Indiegogo, Kickstarter, and even something like Fig. Again, as someone who's been doing this for so many years and now publishing games, what are your thoughts on sort of this whole like crowdfunding generation that we're in now?
Well, we actually depend on crowdfunding. Mm-hmm. We're too small to be able to give you money or get you a loan, for example. And I don't even think that that's a good way to go, mm-hmm. to immediately be in debt to somebody for to try and get your game out. That's unfair, mm-hmm. especially when you're already working against timelines and your very small budget.
Yeah.
Using these things is very necessary. Obviously, crowdfunding has taken a few punches, mm-hmm. and that is also a very it's a very diluted kind of thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be just as spot on with your crowdfunding persona as anything else in your production process.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another place where you need some people. My partner, I'm very fortunate that we teamed up. He's a lawyer who kind of specializes in crowdfunding.
Mm.
So his knowledge of crowdfunding, my knowledge of publishing really did come together quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've had one success and one failure. And while it's never cool to say I had a failure in Kickstarter, mm-hmm. it is very good practice.
Oh,
and
yes.
It's good experience. Luckily, it was venture forth, and fortunately, our developer wanted to just keep going, and it would. Mm-hmm. It took him another, I guess, probably it'll be 9 months longer than he wanted, mm-hmm. because he didn't have the budget he got he wanted right away. But we got the artist to kind of buy into it. We got the sound guy to kind of buy into it. So everybody managed to keep working on it. Mm-hmm. as well as us. I mean, we don't get a dime unless a copy of the game is sold. So mm-hmm. We believe in the game, and we all wanted to just push forward with it.
Yeah. And I've heard stories like that too from other independent developers. I know I recently spoke with Beta Dwarf from Denmark, and when they were working on their two titles, Force and Force Showdown, the team, I think, for a time went without any kind of income coming in, and they basically had to rally together and make a game. And I know on one hand, that is something you definitely don't want happen at any state for any kind of company, but at the same time, it's definitely encouraging to hear like how developers and people who have to come together and get these projects done.
Yeah, and I take my hat off to those guys, because mm-hmm. it is so hard to
yes.
do that kind of thing, because people are under stress,
mm-hmm.
not just trying to get a game out, but trying to live life without enough money,
yeah.
you know, living paycheck to paycheck without the paycheck.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just so stressful. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, you have a very tight team. If one of them leaves for a full-time job, that impacts the game massively.
Mm-hmm.
So if that tends to happen, which it will in a lot of cases, that almost ruins the game a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when you can get a team together to really just believe in the project and move forward, that's kind of an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I think you made a really good point there, Rob, regarding learning from your failures. I think that is definitely a core philosophy of my life as well. I've had a lot of mistakes. I've definitely made a lot with game wisdom and how I approach things, and it really is a learning process. And I'm definitely one of those people who believe that you learn more from your failures than you do your successes.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, in my career, I've been with, you know, huge success games. I've also been involved in miserable failure games, mm-hmm. or games that never even made it to market. Mm-hmm. So you do get a chance to learn from all that. And I've been in a bunch of different companies, and you get to learn from all those different companies. Mm-hmm. Kind of take what you like, what works for you, and leave behind what didn't work for you, what you didn't like. Mm-hmm. And that rounds out everybody. That mm-hmm. turns people into who they are.
Definitely. And I mean, we could easily talk more about what that means with me with Game Wisdom, but for those of you listening, I think you've heard that enough. But going back to talking about crowdfunding, especially what we see today. Now, obviously, the market definitely hit its peak in about like 2012, 2013, when Double Fine sort of lit the fuse for a lot of crowdfunding options for game development.
Yeah.
I guess, in your opinion, or for what you've been seeing in terms of crowdfunding today, how is, I guess, the state of crowdfunding as an option for game makers these days? Like, have you done any crowdfunding campaigns lately, or do you know of any that you've been following, or something along those lines?
Well, our last one was a year ago, mm-hmm. And that was the failure we mentioned. Mm-hmm. Now, while Double Fine lit that fuse, they've also kind of burned it a little bit. Mm-hmm. When you successfully hit a campaign, you make a lot of promises to
yes.
people. And if you can't fulfill those promises, you scare investor or backers away. Mm-hmm. And those backers might be burnt from investing in any games.
Yes.
Especially if a giant number of these companies does the exact same thing, which has happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a trick to convince people that, no, you actually are able to get the game out on time, get the rewards out to people in a timely fashion. And that's difficult to do, especially if when the Kickstarter is over, you just want to get back to making your game.
Mm-hmm.
It is such a double-edged sword. You want to get this money, but you just make all these promises that you just have to keep.
Yeah. And another aspect of that, again, goes into the planning of the Kickstarter as well. Like, as you just said, Rob, if you promise 30, 40 different stretch goals and they all catch, did you really plan your development timeline around those 30 to 40 different stretch goals? Or what happens if you have a massive physical goods rewards, you know, t-shirts, yeah. hats, keychains, the whole likes, and you didn't make the proper logistical plans around that.
Yeah.
And that kind of talk, I actually spoke with a developer about, I think it was in 2015, Anthony Conta, and we talked about those challenges of logistics. And it's, again, one of those things that as a developer, you're not really focusing on. You're thinking about, okay, I want to make this great game. You're not thinking about, oh, who's going to manufacture my keychains? Is it going to be this company in the United States, or am I going to go overseas? Mm-hmm. You're not thinking about that stuff, but all that can easily come back to burn you if you're not careful.
Oh, definitely. Like, that's one of the things, one of my tenets is when you're going into a Kickstarter, mm-hmm. one, make sure you plan the Kickstarter around you making enough money to finish the game, and that includes calculating selling like the physical goods, mm-hmm. like the worst possible scenario of cost of going yes. to rewards and cost you need. Make sure you have that as your bottom line, as the actual goal.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the dream for everybody is to hit like 10 times their goal mm-hmm. and just have money everywhere.
Yes.
But when one of the worst things, one of the hardest things is to just barely
yes,
make your goal.
Definitely.
It's even worse than not making mm-hmm. your goal. Because when you just barely make it, you have to really pinch pennies.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you miss it, well, you can decide whether to keep going or whether to just get a day job and continue that way. It's a much easier problem to deal with than you just made a bunch of promises to people and you barely have money to get by. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough thing.
Yes, definitely. And I'm not going to name names, so I spoke to them off record, but I've spoken to several developers, my mouth just completely slurred there, that just barely broke even. And as you're saying, Rob, they were already pinching pennies to begin with. They wanted, you know, at least 1.5, maybe an extra 10-20% what they were asking for in order to have enough money to do this. And now, as you're saying, you have to now make this game with barely enough money, or maybe even less than what you needed in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another part of the risk, especially in the consumer's eyes, is that the whole aspect of game development is still very much a mystery to a great number of people. Whether you're even for people who play video games on a day-to-day basis, there's very little concrete information about what exactly goes into making a game. And that's been one of the goals of Game Wisdom, is to try and illuminate some of those more abstract concepts so that someone can understand that it's not as simple as just, you know, typing away at keyboard, now your game is multiplayer, or
yeah.
Or why can't you just why does it take an extra 2 months to make your game? Why can't you just release it now and stuff like right. that?
Yeah, it's that process is so convoluted. Mm-hmm. I mean, tools that are out nowadays make it a lot easier and, mm-hmm. and give the ability for people who have a stronger business savvy to make their own game. Mm-hmm. But you still have to learn how Unity works, mm-hmm. and you still have to be able to apply what you know from Unity to your vision.
Yes.
And I know that there's a lot of awesome programmers who look at Unity and just feel like their hands are tied. So mm-hmm. they go. They have to go to the much bigger, stronger engines mm-hmm. to really do what they want to do. Mm-hmm. But yeah, from the beginning, you have to plan and design your game and really know what it is you want.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're going to be missing all your deadlines because you're figuring out how to mm-hmm. get all this stuff into your vision.
Yeah.
Additionally, there's post-production. I mean, mm-hmm. you got to fix all the bugs. You got to find all the
yes.
bugs. Nowadays there's beta testers and whatnot, and even early access, which you're trying to sell games to beta testers. It blows my mind. That part just blows my mind. Mm-hmm. That's how I started my career, was in QA, for AAA titles. And now it seems like QA is now no longer a paid service, but yes. an income service.
I know. My first actual quote-unquote job with the game industry was doing beta testing for Shrapnel Games back in, my God, like early thousands. It seems like a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
And now, as you're saying, Rob, with like early access, you can basically have all your consumers test your game for you. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be my next question for you. But before I get to that, there's one other part that I want to briefly bring up about crowdfunding as well, and more about the lack of concrete information. And I wanted to get your thoughts on this as well. One of the things that we also see from the crowdfunding front is that with all these different games being made, it's very hard for the consumer to understand the exact cost of them. When you have something like Yooka-Laylee, or the game from the Castlevania Symphony of the Night developer, and yeah. they're only asking, like, let's say $250,000 or $500,000, the consumers will think that, oh, you know, if they can make that at $250,000, why does your, you know, pixel art game need $75,000 or $100,000? And, you know, God help you if you need more than $250,000, your game looks nothing like those massive titles.
Yeah, and what those guys tend to do is they're asking for a lot less than they actually need,
mm-hmm.
because they can prove to investors,
yes.
oh, there's a huge interest in our game.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it succeeds or not, if they have a large number of people, they can just go to investors and say, well, take that number and extrapolate it when we release,
mm-hmm.
and this is how much money we plan on making. Give us money. So
exactly. And again, it's very hard for the consumer to know, you know, what's the difference between your $500,000 Kickstarter and his $350,000 Kickstarter. Now, there is an exception to that. I think the tabletop, in terms of like its community and its Kickstarters, it's a little bit easier to see. I mean, you can
yeah.
see like there is a cost to making those tabletop games. And I'm not a tabletop gamer, but I've looked at those Kickstarters in the past, and it is very easy to see how that cost ramps up very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
When you start having, you know, dozens of figurines and boards, and again, the whole logistics of design, production, and shipping.
Yeah, if you don't have like a major, even minor publishing house, like printing all that stuff and finding 3D printers to get your figurines and making sure the art looks good, the expense of that is just insane. Like, and then you have to put it in a box and have art on the box
and then ship it.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing, you can see very easily how that gets up there. But for game development, again, it's still such a mystery. People don't understand why, you know, a game that may only have like 10 hours of gameplay still needs a good amount of money to be made. Why does this roguelike only need $50,000 when this platformer needs $250,000?
Yeah, and from there, it's really about transparency. I mean, really bulleting out where every dollar is going in as much as you can. And just letting people know, okay, well, me as the developer, I'm not going to make any money, but I need to hire an artist, I need to hire a sound guy, and this, I've talked to them, this is how much they're going to need, and, you know, this is what we can do with that amount of money. Now, if we get more, we can do this and this, but when you bullet it out and be as detailed as possible, I think people can understand a little bit more. But in this market of free-to-play games, they're like, well, I don't have to pay any money for this game, so why does it cost so much?
And that is, you know, a topic in of itself for sure. We're talking about the state of the mobile market. I've spoken to several developers in the past at different like positions or different areas of mobile design, and there's definitely, I think, somewhat of a growing cynicism towards mobile gaming, especially for traditional console, handheld, and PC gamers. And for like developers, as we said earlier, the market is so saturated with free-to-play and IAP focused titles that it's very hard for someone to say, I have this unique game, it's, you know, on the challenging side, I want to try and sell in the mobile market. That game will most likely be buried within like a few hours of the iOS store.
Yeah, and it is. And iOS, unlike Steam, doesn't promise you that it's going to get in front of everybody. I remember before iOS even got out, you had to make deals with the publisher, or sorry, with the phone companies to even get your game noticed. Let alone, you know, if you had a small game, you're never going to get seen. And then when Apple came out, everyone was just amazed because the store was so much better and so much more open. And now with the millions of apps on there, it's gone back to that very small bottleneck that only a few games get noticed. Like I saw today, they have the Super Mario Runner, and I clicked on it. I'm like, I'll download this and check it out. Oh no, it's just an ad for when it comes out. I can just I can subscribe and find out when it's finally out. But it's taking up all this ad space where an actual game that's out could be. So you're battling against all this that Apple. I mean, they're in the business to make money, and that's understandable. So they're going to put out the most popular games that they think are going to generate a lot of income.
And when I spoke with Rahul Sagal of Roach Interactive, who did the game Bird of Light a few months ago, we talked about how he had nothing but trouble trying to get the game, not even get it out there, but get people interested in it on the iOS front. He had a battle to make sure he kept his protagonist, who was going to be a young girl, and then about making the game be challenging. And he eventually decided to switch it to the PC with Steam, and I think he's found a far more accepting consumer base on Steam rather than on iOS. And it's just very interesting about these two consumer markets. And I guess that takes me to a very interesting question for you, Rob. Again, as someone who's been doing indie publishing and has had their hand in mobile development as well, I guess, in your opinion, what would you say are like the types of consumers you find with the mobile side versus the PC or Steam clientele?
Well, The mobile phone side is really a casual gamer. There are people who basically used to play on Facebook, you know, with the Farmville and that kind of thing. And they transitioned over to mobile games because they now have these smartphones that are very easy to navigate. PC games are much more complex. Mm-hmm. They take some of them take a massive learning curve to even know, you know, how to work it. Mm-hmm. Sorry, there's a truck going by. Should have closed my windows, but okay. Anyway, the learning curve on some of these games, like especially the esports, if you're trying to watch a game, the complexity of these to even learn what's going on. For me, it's fascinating to try and watch and figure it out. But for someone who's hearing about esports and wants to check it out, they're going to be turned off in 5 minutes.
Oh, yes. I mean, right now, they just ran on TBS. They had like Friday night Counter-Strike tournaments. And that just blows my mind that we're seeing something like that on TV. But there are so many esports focused games that it's just impossible, unless you've played the game, to know what's even going on. Like, I don't even watch, like, Dota or League of Legends, because I have no idea. All I see is a bunch of effects and names popping up saying they've been killed. But I do watch, like, competitive fighting game tournaments. I used to watch StarCraft 2 for, like, a little bit of time, but for, like, the esports, like, the fighting game side, it's just fascinating to see, like, what again, master level play is like for these titles.
Yeah, actually, my favorite part of watching Dota is the team selection. Mm-hmm. Like that fascinates me because there's 100 plus characters, and these players have to know the pluses and minuses of every single one.
Oh, yes.
As the other team picks their characters, and that part just blows my mind. I see the strategy there, and that's easier to understand. Mm-hmm. And then the real time play. I more pay attention to the commentators who are telling the story of how the game is going. Mm-hmm. Occasionally they mention different powers, and I have to learn each character's power to follow that part. Mm-hmm. But it's easier to just listen to the story and know who's winning and losing.
Yeah. And I think 1-to-1, one-v-one games, I think, are going to be really popular among the esports line. But we're also seeing things like Overwatch, which has definitely become a major hit. And there's, of course, Hearthstone as well. I've watched Hearthstone for a time, and it's kind of interesting to see these games, to look at the games that you either play versus the ones that you're never going to touch in a million years.
Yeah. Things like Hearthstone are interesting because I'm a big tabletop gamer, or at least I have been in the past. I haven't had time lately, but playing games like Race for the Galaxy, which is a card game, and that is very difficult to teach somebody, and then watching Hearthstone or trying to learn Hearthstone, I mean, there's so much iconography that you just have to take in and understand, that is really what the game is, not the pictures, not the effects. The game is in the numbers. And knowing that is the confusing part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just very challenging, again, like for people who are trying to watch these games, for the new person, you not only have to learn what the game's about, but you have to actually learn about what they're doing. Like with something like watching tennis or football, you can watch and have a pretty good idea of who's winning, what's going on, who's being stopped. But when you're watching something like Dota 2, like when things start getting crazy, it's impossible to know like just what just happened there.
Yeah, the scoring is difficult because they just have one goal, but the getting to that goal is so convoluted and hard to follow that like you could see this team making all kinds of progress and suddenly they lose and you're like, how did that happen?
Yes. And, oh my goodness, as someone who tried to learn League of Legends and Dota 2, I have nightmares of that. when your team loses if they were already winning.
Yeah.
That I've long since retired my hopes of it being a Dota 2 champion there. Mm. And getting back to what we were talking about with the mobile versus PC market, it definitely seems like PC gamers are far more willing to spend the extra money, but then are just completely opposed to microtransactions or post-retail purchases.
Yeah, Zavix Tower, who started as free to play. I mean, again, he approached me and I said, well, we can't take games that are free to play. It's just too hard. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, yeah, that's absolutely right. On Steam, he was just getting slammed by people who didn't even play the game, mm-hmm. who like downloaded it and were like, no, I don't like free to play games. Mm-hmm. And I saw the same thing. There's a game I actually like to play on mobile, and I'm just going to it's Shop Heroes. Mm-hmm. And it's just a silly free-to-play game. I haven't spent a penny, and that's sad because mm-hmm. I really like the game, and yet I don't ever pay them. Mm-hmm. But they just brought it to Steam, and I looked it up, and the reviews are just like mm-hmm. so negative.
Yeah,
and it's really just people saying, I don't like free-to-play. I don't like microtransactions. And my response is, well, what did you think was going on here? Mm-hmm. But yes, it's a more traditional gaming platform. People who used to spend $60 for every game they played, they now have a lot more options, but they are willing to pay for their the better experience. And mm-hmm. You know, they're dedicated to certain publishers or developers or genres, mm-hmm. and they will just continue to eat it up because they dedicate their time to playing these games, and there's never enough content to sate them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was talking to developers about this. Well, by the time you're listening to this cast, it will be a few weeks ago. But for today, in terms of what we're talking about right now, we were talking about how games have really developed into this quote-unquote games as a service model, where it's no longer about putting out a game and then you move on to your next game. It's now you play out this game and people expect you to keep working on it. They expect to get more value out of this game. And there are so many examples of this, not just in the mobile space, but also on the PC side of things. We have companies like Paradox Interactive, who their 4X games get months and months of support and patches and expansions. And even something like Payday 2, which I've played a lot of, they've had, I think they've gone over 100 different updates, and I think they have at least 40-plus DLCs you can buy for that game now.
Yeah, my favorite of those is Terraria, and which is, you know, they moved to Starbound now, but like Terraria, every year they'd have such a massive update that anyone who had kind of stopped playing it would now go and replay it because there was so much new content.
Yes.
And that is, unless you're making a ton of money, that is really hard to get yourself to do.
Definitely. Definitely with that. And it's, again, that kind of risk reward. Do you commit to making 5 to 6 months more content for your game if you don't even know how it's going to sell month one? And then, but what if you release your game and there's just not enough value there at the start? And there's just this whole ecosystem these days of how games have really transitioned from when they first come out to where they're at, either 5 months down the line, 2 years down the line. And that's a definitely good lead into talking about early access, which is another just massive changer for what it means to make a game. Yeah. And I'm sure you are well aware of that, considering the three games that you were talking about, they've all three of them are either on or finished or will be finished by the time this cast will be done.
Yeah. And they've all had different they're all in different spaces.
Yes.
Reassembly had a really dedicated team that Arthur found in forums that were really enjoying a very similar title. These 2D, vector-based space titles, they all inspired him to make Reassembly. But these forums of people, actually one of the games went down, and so he found this forum that just he shifted over to Reassembly. And so that dedication led him to have a very successful early access. In fact, he was approached by Steam that he could skip early access. But this was a couple of years ago where it was kind of growing. Venture Forth is one where we're trying really hard to get people to play early access. And that is, I mean, that's like 100% my job to get to happen. And I am just trying my damnedest to get to happen. One of our strategies is to sell the game for slightly more to keep people from coming in and panning us for not being complete.
Mm-hmm.
But that strategy is hard to win people over by because why pay a little more when you can just wait and pay regular price?
Definitely.
But Zavix Tower, again, they actually had a built-in audience to go through that early access period when he moved to a paid game, because he had all these dedicated players that really enjoyed the format, and they switched over to the new format just fine. A lot of whom actually, when they anyone who paid anything in the free-to-play game got the paid game for free. Mm-hmm. And some people who just dedicated hours got the game for free. And he had a ton of early access input and good reviews, because his reviews start out very bad. And ever since, he's just been getting it up and up. He finally crossed 80% recently. Mm-hmm. So that really helped him. So having a prior audience is very important for early access. And gaining that audience afterwards is just a pain. It's a giant bull in your face.
Definitely. And what you were just saying, Rob, regarding pricing the game higher to get people who are going to give the game a fair look, there is a huge psychology and marketing decision behind even just simply pricing your game at any stage of it. Yeah. And there's definitely a very strong issue or very strong debates about just what exactly should games be priced at. Now, obviously, you know, in the perfect world, everyone would get as much money as they need. But in today's setting, it's becoming a lot harder these days to figure out just how much a game is worth. By the time this cast goes up, I should have a post talking more about sort of this perception behind a $60 game. And it's becoming very tricky for developers, not just in the AAA space, but indies, to effectively price their game. As we've said earlier, PC gamers and those on Steam, they are willing to pay more, but at the same time, you still can't go too high up. Like, and sometimes even that difference between like $5, we've seen like consumers go, oh, you know, your game is $15, I'll wait till it's $10, or your game is $30, I'll wait till it's $20. And it's just a very sticky situation, and it's a very dangerous one, because you really only have one shot in most cases to get your pricing right.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and I know we're starting to really rethink how we suggest pricing to people, because initially we just kind of had, okay, it'll be, you know, $15 was reassembly, that worked out really well, so we're going to suggest that to everybody. But again, we're going to have to get very precise and really look at the game and figure out, okay, where can this live? Zavix Tower, for example, is a relatively deep game that has a lot of replay value. Mm-hmm. But when you look at it for the first time, it doesn't look like it. Mm-hmm. So when you see it for the first time on Steam, you're like, I don't think that's $15. In fact, that looks like $10 at best. So we have to fight against the actual depth of the game and work that's gone into it versus what the perception is when someone first sees it. Mm-hmm. That's a balancing act.
Yes, definitely. And it's becoming all that more, especially with, again, the quality that we're seeing from the independent market. I've seen games with, you know, very basic pixel art graphics with ridiculously complex game designs, just as I see games with like the latest Unreal whatever number engine we're up to, or, you know, super photorealistic graphics, but are very basic in terms of their design. And it used to be that the quality of the graphics was a measurement of the quality of the game. And that whole idea has just gone down by the wayside by now.
Yeah, like, I'm trying to remember the first one I played, but like Going Home, for example, where there's a very rich graphics and the game itself is just telling you a linear story. Mm-hmm. So you're just kind of walking around this world that is lush and beautiful, but really there's no depth to it except for some writing. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate very good writing, but if it's a linear story, I'm a little more confused as to why it's a game. Mm-hmm. Now, my favorite kind of example the other way is Dwarf Fortress. Now, that came out over 10 years ago initially, but that's when I started to play it. And even then, its complexity and depth was so high that the learning curve was impossible for a lot of people to follow. Mm-hmm. But now it is so far beyond in terms of depth any type of game that's out there. And I know like Terraria and Minecraft and stuff, they're actually approaching that kind of thing, that kind of depth. But these guys just keep going, and they're on Patreon, and they earn all kinds of – they earn money enough to continue this art project that will last forever, it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're not the first one I've heard to say the genius behind Dwarf Fortress. It's very much a game that was, going back to talking about sort of the art versus the business, it was a game developed as 100% art. The man behind it, he and his brother, I believe, they wanted to make this game. They didn't care about selling it. Right. They just wanted it out there. And that's kind of what we see from the independent space. We're seeing games that if these teams didn't make them, they would never be made otherwise.
Yeah. And the great part about Dwarf Fortress, for anyone who doesn't know, is that it's all ASCII art. And it looks like a mess when you just see screenshots of it. But I always relate it to The Matrix, where he's looking at the screen of green that's flowing down. And he says, well, you know, I no longer see code. I see that's a brunette. That's a redhead. Well, it's the same with Dwarf Fortress. Like, okay, that's a tree. That's a wolf. And it's just a fascinating experience.
Yeah. And what we're seeing, like going back to early access, is that, and this also leads back into talking about this level of transparency, is that consumers now can see a game that's literally from, you know, alpha 0.001 and watch it develop into a full-fledged thing. And Minecraft would be a really good example of that. Minecraft really came out of that at like that perfect time to capture everyone's interest, and then to watch it grow and grow and grow. And it's just fascinating to see like how these games really take shape. Because again, 10, 15 years ago, we would never see a game in its beta form, much less its alpha form. We would see, you know, version 1.0, final version. There's no more work going to be done on this game.
Yeah, one of the things I'm having the most trouble with is I'm a big fan of like the roller coaster games, Roller Coaster Tycoon theme park, and they just came out with Roller Coaster Tycoon World. It's in early access, and I went, okay, I'm going to buy that. I'm real excited. The limitations, it's like you play it, and you're like, wait a minute, I can only do two things. I can place rides and paths and maybe a couple of stores, and that's it. I can't like, I can't build roller coasters. I can't do this and that. And you are just very frustrated because you know this deep game that you used to play, that you used to love, and you hope that it's going to get there, but you play it for 10 minutes and you're like, okay, I get it. What next?
Yeah. And and like these games can have anywhere from, you know, 2 to 3 months of early access to 2 to 3 years of early access.
Yeah, this one's easily the latter.
Yeah. Speaking about roller coaster games, have you heard of Planet Coaster or Parkitech?
Yeah, I actually have both.
Nice.
I have both of them, I'm pretty sure. Parkitech, I bought that basically at the same time as the other one.
I have Parkitech, but I've been really eyeing Planet Coaster because I think I'm like you. I remember the days of Roller Coaster Tycoon, Theme Park, and like the early Bullfrog simulation games. I'm waiting. If anyone's listening to this cast right now, someone make a theme hospital, a spiritual successor. Exactly. I would be happy there.
Yeah. I was actually very interested in the sim games, like the game studio one. I thought it was terrible in terms of depth, but I couldn't stop playing it. But yeah, there was a new, is that the one you mentioned first before Parkitect?
Planet Coaster.
Planet Coaster. Do I actually have that one? Is that the Frontier one?
Yes.
Okay. That one I'm super looking forward to. I do need to buy that one.
Yeah, and it's just amazing. Again, like, it's kind of interesting to see how these genres that we're playing in the independent space have really fallen out of favor in the AAA market. Like, we would never see a game like Dwarf Fortress from a AAA developer. That would never happen in a million years. Much like how there was a time where everyone thought survival horror was no longer viable. And now we see the likes of PT and Layers of Fear, Five Nights at Freddy's, etc. And now we're seeing, you know, a new Resident Evil game in that style.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the survival horror, I mean, there are some that I really like, mm-hmm. but it's just nuts now. I mean, mm-hmm. there's so many coming out, and they're all excellent. You have, like, for me, I don't like them as much. Mm-hmm. I have to pick and choose the ones I think are going to be great.
Yeah.
For me, anyway. I'm trying to remember the one I really like there. It's, Don't Starve. That's the one.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And that's a great tangent lead in that they're now working on their own Dwarf Fortress-style game. I think it's called Oxygen Not Included, which is going to be like a side-scroller Rimworld Dwarf Fortress-esque game.
Cool.
Yeah, and it is really a great time to be a consumer on this front. But I think it's also a very tricky time to be a publisher, as we've said, with pricing and especially marketing. Here's a question that I definitely wanted to ask you more about, Robert. Again, with your experience as an independent publisher, in terms of like pricing these games, what are like some like are there any major tells or like design elements that may sort of clue you into like pricing a game? Almost like I was like joking about this to myself, or like almost like a game design appraiser, you know, like if this game has multiplayer, I can charge X amount of dollars. But if it features a standard story, I gotta deduct this amount and so on.
I know in the game I had mentioned one of those game studio games, mm-hmm. that's how their engine works. Mm-hmm. And once you figure out the engine, you get bestsellers all the time.
Yeah.
But like in this case, for me, it seems to boil down to two things.
Mm-hmm.
One is how it looks, because that's how you sell it.
Mm-hmm.
That's when people click on it, then and it looks great, then they're more likely to buy it or put it on their wish list. And then two, it's the depth, because mm-hmm. The look can get you to pay more, but mm-hmm. the problem is if the depth isn't there, the quality of design isn't there, you get bad reviews. Yeah. And that immediately turns people off. If you see like a 60% or less on mm-hmm. Steam, you're like, no. Yeah. But on the other hand, if you see a game with decent reviews and great graphics, or graphics that are stylized in a way you like,
mm-hmm.
then that's almost a definitely I will take it. Yeah, that's basically what I boil it down to, but I'm sure there are a lot more complexities than that. I think those features that you mentioned, multiplayer, etc., are things that are more like genre types that people look for. So for me, I don't play multiplayer. I always like solo player. So if a game is multiplayer only, that's a turnoff. But if a game is multiplayer and solo, I'll do that. Like when I played WoW years ago, I just only did the one player stuff,
mm-hmm.
and that ended pretty fast. Mm-hmm. So, that's what I think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just very tricky these days. Again, as you said, Rob, that graphics are going to be the first thing someone sees, but it becomes then much more than that when you're trying to get those reviews. And in today's market, especially with games as a service, it's no longer about the, you know, first 2 to 3 weeks of selling your game and that determine whether it's a success or not. Now you got to worry about the next 6 to 12 months, especially if you're going to keep supporting and keep, you know, changing this game over that period of time.
Yeah. And the problems we're running into is just getting more people to look at it and getting more people mm-hmm. to look at it. Because again, we've launched the Avix Tower and we're in that space. It's been a month and a half and we're seeing that rat tail. We're down at the bottom of, we are getting a constant burn of people buying the game, but we need to figure out ways to increase that and mm-hmm. make more people see the game who actually want that kind of game.
Yeah.
Because it is a very specific type of game.
Yes.
One of the things that you were talking about that really came to mind was Planetary Annihilation, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
The trailer for that, the graphics, they looked amazing. And I was so on board to try it out, even as a multiplayer game. But the reviews were horrible. I mm-hmm. think they you know, basically put lipstick on a pig. They basically sold this look and feel that when you play it did not translate. And mm-hmm. that burns a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I was there with Planetary Annihilation. I followed them from the Kickstarter to release, and it definitely, I think, became a victim of its own success. As we said earlier in this cast regarding stretch goals, they had My God, I think they had almost like 15 or 20 different stretch goals with
that
game.
They made a good success on Kickstarter, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it just overwhelmed them. And then there are definitely some issues, again, of perception and what people were buying with the game. When the game was when it was considered 1.0 on Steam, it literally didn't have a save feature. And it's very tricky these days about what consumers expect with their games. And I'm sure we could easily spend another hour or two just on that one topic. But it is true. Like, if you launch, like, let's say you're building a RPG, and people will come into that expecting major elements of that. But let's say you're trying to build something different. Like, let's say you're building an RPG where there is no experience. It becomes that much of a harder sell. Like, the genre is a good first step, but then it becomes even more than that. I'll give you an example with Renowned Explorers, which was my favorite game of last year from Abbey Games. There is literally nothing else like that game. It's a roguelike strategy RPG adventure game. And it sounds amazingly awesome, but at the same time, how the hell do you market something like that? Yeah. You can't market to a traditional strategy fan. You can't market to a traditional roguelike fan. It, as you're saying with something like Zavix Tower, if it is a very niche game, it becomes that much harder to tell people why they should care about it.
Yeah, that is true. One of the things that I liked about it that drew me to it initially was that it has the look and feel of the old Bard's Tale from 1990 or 89 when it launched. That that was a game I grew up playing and I loved it. It was my really the first RPG I really experienced. And when I saw this game, I was like, yes, I love this game. And I was just lucky enough to get to partner with him, and I play that game all the time. So that was what drew me to it. I know then, and that's why I'm confident that there's this audience out there for it, because it struck me, struck a chord with me.
Yep. And sometimes you just never know, like, what games are going to, you know, hit that market. Again, like something like Stardew Valley just like came out. Like, no one was really calling for that type of game, and it just resonated with a lot of people.
Yeah.
All right. I'm trying to think. Again, we can easily jump onto any number of topics, I feel. But I know we are definitely getting – we're over our little hour time frame. I'm sure you have to get going soon at some point tonight. I guess – before I guess we move into our final set of questions then for you, Rob, are there any other topics, either regarding indie publishing, developing, or anything else we talked about that you would like to expand on or bring up here?
Right now, there's an article on Gamma Sutra that I think was very important. It was a guy who said, do indie games need publishers anymore? And he goes through a very nice set of steps. And I mean, his argument is that, you know, if you're an indie and you do you need to go find somebody? And if you find somebody, is the benefit that it's their big name like Devolver or even Behemoth or something like that that gets you sales? Or is it do you not even need that? And I thought that was it was very interesting. And the points I brought up after that are, well, if you want to go for a publisher like that, they're not going to necessarily just pick anybody. So, yeah, sure, pitch it to them. And if they take it, then yes, that's perfect. But if they don't and you still need help, then yeah, you might need someone to kind of fill in the gaps. There was another point brought up that most indies can make enough money to sustain them for their next game. And that's good for someone who all they want to do is make games by themselves and not have to work full time. But if you want to expand and you want to grow and mature as a game developer and even as a company, you're going to need someone to help to learn from, at the very least, to expand your knowledge of business and of marketing and get some people to help you out and join your team. And that allows you to make bigger and bigger and bigger titles. In terms of like rev share, that's a big important thing because you're giving away a portion of your game and, you know, you want all that money. So I figure for us, we take a very small percentage. We take 15% or less. And that's all dependent on when your game's going to launch. So if you're going to launch in 2 months, we'll take 10. But if you're going to launch in a year or 2 years, we'll take 15 because there's a lot of risk for us. But, you know, we don't want to take more than that because if the game does well, we're going to be very happy, you know. We don't need to take more than that, especially if we got several projects running. So that, I feel, is a very strong point. And you, and also there's that point of does a, if a publisher gives you money up front that you have to pay back or something like that. That's another piece of complexity. Do you need that money up front? Do you want to go through crowdfunding? Like, if you don't, then that's, you do need that. So it's all about needs and finding the right fit for you. Yeah, just talking around, doing your research. That's really what it's all about.
Yeah. And it's a really interesting topic. Again, as we've seen, it's very hard to like know what works and what doesn't work. Again, you have games like Undertale, Stardew Valley, and a lot more that, you know, I could probably spend time listing and finding out that really didn't have a marketing plan or a giant marketing campaign that did well. And then you have games like The Darkest Dungeon, for instance, who spent over a year preparing their game both on and off Kickstarter to get that game to the point of success that it needed to be. And it's one of those topics, much like game design as a whole, that it's very hard to find concrete information on. It's such a abstract kind of concept for a lot of people. I guess one final question then for me before we start to wrap things up, that I asked this when I had Daniel on from Black Shell Media. I want to ask this for you, Rob, as, again, someone who's been doing indie publishing. For developers who may be listening to this cast, are there any major do's and don'ts that you see indie developers do when it comes to any kind of aspect, when it comes to marketing their games, that you would be so kindly to like point out to people listening?
Sure. This is, again, a point brought up in the article, and it is something that I dealt with back when I was working for a, you know, AAA studio, and that is, do you go show your stuff off at a conference? And that is a tough question. If you can get a free ride there, like to partner up with like an IndieCade or something like that, then sure, as long as you can afford the trip back and forth. The cost benefit there, you know, it's not that high. Those conferences are generally for, to be honest, publishers. They're looking to find developers. They, you know, talk with partners, potential partners, but they're the ones who are going to try to attract developers. Developers don't so much attract publishers walking by. So, you know, kind of reduce your costs in terms of getting yourself out there in the physical space. Spend a lot more time working on the social space. Make sure you can get a bunch of followers who are not developers. You want followers who are interested in games, in buying games. Developers are just developers. You know, they're not as interested in buying a ton of games. They do buy a lot of games, but they're more focused on marketing their game. So if you're speaking to the, if you're preaching to the choir, then you're not going to sell anything. So get that set up, get your Facebook set up, get some people on your side, do some research on other games, get into forums, all of that, as much as you can while you're developing this very complex game, which is taking up most of your time to begin with. So, I mean, it's a lot of work, but a lot of it is free, and you want to take advantage of that, free or low cost, and take advantage of that as much as humanly possible, because you can get a lot of mileage out of it. And that's what I would say is the most important marketing lesson, is really figure out what your cost-benefit analysis is for any dollar spent. You want to make sure, and this is like how mobile developers measure their success, is like, what is the cost per user, and like the, sorry, CPA, cost per acquisition, and then how much is your average player spending? And usually only, you know, 5% or less of your people are even spending money. But a few of them are spending a lot of money. So it all balances out. It just, you just have to do as much of the math as you possibly can, or go with your gut here and there. Most of the time it's going with your gut. Yeah, just try not to spend money where you don't have to, or talk to people about that.
Yeah. And all really good points there, Rob. And I know we are coming up on an hour and a half of talking, and I can easily feel that we could probably go for like another hour and a half easily on this. But I think we're going to start to wrap it up now. This has definitely been a great cast with you, Robin. It's definitely another one, those ones where I could, it's very easy that I think we could easily have segued into who knows how many more topics we could have an interesting discussion on.
We've lost the path several times.
Yeah. But I would definitely love to have you back on for, you know, any number of topics, really. I think we could easily dedicate an hour easily to any of them.
Oh, I'd love to come back. This has been a lot of fun.
Awesome. All right, so before we say goodnight for today's episode, I guess my final question for you, Rob, then is, do you have any final thoughts or anything you would like to say to any like fans of your studio, any fans of the games you publish, you know, just a final thoughts from you, basically?
Really, just keep doing what you love, whether it be publishing or whether it be designing games and making games or just playing them. I mean, it's just a fun industry. It's worth all the effort you put into it, whether just playing or making, and just have fun with it. I mean, there aren't too many businesses like ours out there that you can just enjoy and make a living off of, or just, you know, take your day job and just lose it for a while. It's just a terrific business to be in, and I'm grateful for every minute.
Awesome. Great words to end on. So, with all that said, we will wrap it up here. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links on the front page under Submissions Wanted. For podcast guests, like I always say, student, developer, enthusiast, whatever, if you're interested in talking about the game industry, I can easily spend 40 minutes plus talking to you here. Be sure to follow me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer for the latest updates on new content, as well as thoughts from me throughout the day. Also, subscribe to the Game Wisdom YouTube channel for daily videos of Let's Breaks, game examinations, indie spotlights, and even my own personal vlog. You can find that on YouTube by just searching Game Wisdom, and there are links to that on the front page. And last but not least, be sure to check out our Patreon campaign under Game Wisdom. Your donations can help to keep Game Wisdom funded and allow me to grow things while supporting myself and my household. Any donations will be greatly appreciated, and we can hit some goals. It will mean more great content for everyone to enjoy. So, with all that said, Rob, again, it has been a pleasure talking with you tonight. Definitely want to stay in touch with you, and I can't wait to talk to your developer contacts about their games in terms of when this recording will probably be real soon. And for those of you listening to it, those casts should be up respectively in the coming weeks.
Sounds great.
All right. So, with all that said, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Hope you have a great rest of the week, and I will see you all again next time. Take care.